Test 1, 2, 3, 4.
My interview today is with Mrs. Edith Brame of McAllen, Texas. She moved to the Valley in 1917 when she was 12 years old. After some 30 years of teaching in the McAllen school system, Mrs. Brame retired last year. Although she is now 68 years old, she does not feel that the policy of forcing teachers or other people, regardless of what profession they're in, to retire at age 65 is good. In fact, Mrs. Brame is a good example of the old saying, "You're only as old as you feel." The interview is a recollection of early life in the Valley and a look at the future.
Ms. Brame, could you tell me something about when you arrived in the Valley? About what age were you and the conditions that you found on your way down here?
All right. I was born in the Middle West in the state of Iowa. In 1916, my mother and father came down with A.J. McCall Land Company on an excursion, a 10-day trip. All of their expenses, I think, amounted to $40 for both of them. It was just a winter vacation. When they returned, they had bought two tracts of land, an 80 acres on the old depot road north of McAllen, and a 57-acre tract directly across from the new El Centro Mall out on North Jackson Road, which incidentally is named for my family. My name is Jackson. In 1917, March 1917, my mother and father again came to the Valley on an excursion train. Before they left, my older brother, about 24, my youngest brother, 15, my youngest sister, 14, and I, 12, started out in two automobiles for South Texas. They were both King cars. I'm sure you never heard of a King car. One was a six-cylinder one, too. We came via Blue Book. That means that we had a book that was resembled in thickness a Sears and Roebuck catalog, and it had routes and description of the distances and the signs and the markers from place to place. We had the pages given to us to follow to get down to as far as San Antonio. We left one car in Oklahoma. For some reason, it refused to run. It was later shipped back to Iowa. The four of us came on, five of us came on to San Antonio. When we arrived there, my older brother found it was 300 miles onto the valley. And since his little three-year-old boy, who is Barney Jackson, who has Town and Country Grocery Store in McAllen, number one, had the whooping cough, so he decided he'd come to the Valley on the train. We took him to the station, and we started out. He didn't know how we were going to get down here. We didn't know either. We drove to Skidmore. Somebody directed us to Skidmore. We spent the night there. 100 miles in a half a day. That was good driving. Someone then directed us to Alice. We ate our lunch there. We went over many cattle guards. It was just a trail through the brushland. And from there, we were directed on to Hebbenville. We'd had some flat tires, so the first thing we had to do when we arrived in Hebbenville is go to a garage and get an inner tube mended. A Latin American man owned the garage. on a piece of paper, he tried to draw out a little plot of how we'd get from Heavensville to Mission. And then he added, when he finished, you may get through and you may not. That wasn't a very happy thought to sleep on. I went back to the hotel. They did have a nice hotel. I remember we had a dinner served in courses that night, Sunday night. The next morning, we got up about 4 o'clock. We didn't have any breakfast. We walked through the sand back to the garage, got the car, had one spare tire, no extra water or gasoline in the car. We started out. Just as we arrived at the outskirts of the town coming south, we had a flat tire. Of course, we had to put on our spare, and we had to wait until a nearby garage opened and we could get the tube repaired. The man in the garage said it would be almost impossible to get through that wilderness commission without a guide. But there was a young Anglo-American boy who spent his time guiding people back and forth to the valley. He happened to be in town, and for $12 he came with us to Mission. We went through 2 American ranches, the Reed Ranch, which is about 35 miles out of Heavenville. We pulled sand all the way. We were not in high gear at all. It was a little easier going from there, from the Reed Ranch, to the Wells Ranch, which I believe the Bensons own now. We were running short on gasoline. We still hadn't had any food. And the young man knew where there was no one at home. He knew where they kept their gasoline. So we helped ourselves to 2 or 3 gallons, gave him money to pay for it on his return. He went with us to Mission. And then in the middle of the afternoon, we arrived at our home place, which had been newly constructed on Jackson Road. My father, in the meantime, my brother had arrived the day before. He didn't know where we were. He didn't know how we were coming. As long as my parents were still in the north, we sent a night letter back every night. But after they left, we didn't think to get in touch with them down here. He had been up too far to call Raymondville to see if we had been shipped on, our cars had put onto a flat railroad car and shipped over the sand from Kingsville. They hadn't seen it. The only other way was, of course, via Laredo. And if it ever rained, no one could ever make it over the old military highway. Well, anyway, when he arrived home, we had arrived in the valley. About 3 o'clock in the afternoon, we hadn't had any food. And we were 3 hungry, tired, and yet happy young.
Well, now when you say the possibility of your car having been shipped down here by a train, was that one of the methods they used? If you made it as far as Kingsville, or if they took
the Yes, there were no roads. There were no roads through the sand, and a car couldn't hope to get through. A car was put onto a flat car in the railroad and shipped over the sand. There was no road to the valley until along in the 20s when the road was completed to South Fury. It was a caliche road at first.
It seems real strange that, that you mentioned the sand, because people, you don't really imagine that there's sand, say on Highway 77, now you drive along and you see this scrub brush, but you don't see all the sand dunes and stuff.
No, and because there's some vegetation covering that sand. And really, coming the way we did, we pulled sand for about 35 miles. Yeah. And this driver knew the tracks. Sometimes there would be 3 or 4 of this guide, 3 or 4 tracks. And if we had taken the wrong one, we wouldn't have known which one to take. We would have bogged down, perhaps, and broken a spring. Mm. On the car. A car had broken a spring, I didn't know. But he knew the ones that were safe to take. And we'd come to one of these watering places, a tank and a windmill, and of course the cattle hoof marks would be all around, and there'd be a half a dozen roads angling off from that watering place, and how we would have known which one to take. it's just been impossible to know without a guide. And the roads down here in the valley were terrible in the early days. We still had soldiers stationed here in McAllen, as well as up at Sam Fordyce. And there were many army trucks. We had no paved roads up down the valley, just this main highway. And it would become so full of ruts, so badly cut up, that a car could hardly get across. And when it became almost impassable, the highway department blocked off a section of the road, turned the water, and irrigated the road as we would our fields, then let it dry, and then they'd run a drag over it. And it would be smooth for a while.
Until the next rain came.
Until the next rain.
Yeah. You speak of Sam Fordyce. Is this a community or a ranch or what?
There's very little at Sam Fordyce anymore. It's before you get to La Jolla. There is a gin, I believe, and I think perhaps there were a few little stores there. But there were soldiers stationed there, and the railroad. That was the end of the railroad. It went on up from Mission to Sam Fordyce in those days.
It seems like it. Well, of course, now I think that there's a big power plant out there or something. It's out there close to La Jolla.
Yes, it's a little bit before you get to La Jolla, yeah. I believe.
Mm-hmm. What conditions did you find here? Well, of course, coming here from Iowa, what had you envisioned whenever you left there, coming down here, the community itself, the houses, what was it like when you arrived here?
Well, of course, I was disappointed at first. The way my mother had described it, I thought the whole valley was a rose garden. Roses blooming everywhere in January, she said. And I was disappointed. I like flowers, you know. Mm-hmm. And I was disappointed just to see a few roses here and there in the yards. Our house was built, our home was built down on just across the railroad tracks on North Jackson. People from all over the valley came to see the house. It was two-story. They wanted to see that house with a cement foundation and oak floors and woodwork. Many of the houses, not all of them, but many of them were built with the boards going up and down, you know, parallel. Then across horizontally. They went the other way. We had a beaver board put on the walls. It was called beaver board, and the stuff warped, too, I can tell you. They didn't have any plasterboard, any sheetrock as we have it today. It was called beaver board. But many of them, they were just the layers put over the up and down boards, you know.
Yes,
and, of course, there were only fireplaces. That's all we had as long as I lived out on the farm. My mother cooked on a kerosene range. We had no electricity in those days, no telephone, and we had a fireplace as our source of heat. That and a little kerosene burner, a little stove that you could carry around that we used in the bathroom.
Mm-hmm.
But needless to say, we were chilly much of the time.
Well, were the winters down here, did it seem like they were any cooler in those days than they are now?
They seemed almost colder because we didn't have the heating facilities.
Uh-huh.
They must have been just about as cold or almost colder because I recall the land company had, in the contract, they had agreed to put out 10 acres of grapefruit trees on the 57 acres, our home place. And those had been put out. They hadn't been banked. And I think it was about the 7th or 8th of March. There was a freeze, and we lost all those trees.
Oh, my. When you speak of the land companies, of course, now everyone is familiar with the use of the land company bringing people in, or the use that they made of the trains to bring people down here. But what about, you hear reports that they used to bring people down on the train, and they would just have the same carload of fruit and stuff lined up around the train there. we would see carloads after carloads of fruit, but it would actually be the same ones. Did these land companies use gimmicks and stuff to bring people in?
I don't recall anything like that. There were a few show orchards, show places. Yes. A.J. McCall out on the highway on McCall and McCall Road. Mm-hmm. The A.J. McCall place was a show place, and they had an orchard. I remember they had one tree fenced off, and they had 1 year's fruit and then the second year's fruit on the same tree to show how long it would hang on. There was an orchard in Mission, the Volts, I believe, orchard, and the Cobflash, I believe it was, at Mercedes. There were those three orchards, which were the big producing orchards back in 1917. I do know that many people who lived here would drive, they called it, for the excursion. They would get so much a day taking, say, a 7-passenger or 5-passenger car. And I do know that they didn't turn these prospective buyers loose. They had a schedule that had to be followed. And, of course, there were knockers down here, you know. And the land companies were not in the business for their help. They were in the business to sell land. And I'm sure they overrated some aspects of the valley. But on the other hand, if it hadn't been for the land companies, this area would not have been developed the way it was in the early days.
Well, it seems like that, you know, evidently most of the land people were what would you call it, legitimate in their dealings, and they tried to, like you say, they oversold some of the land, but still they were fairly honest in their dealings and kept their word almost.
Yes, and I don't think, now A.J. McCall didn't have anything when he died, as I remember. And I don't know that there was Stewart Land Company, and of course there was Sherry that developed Sherry Land. Of course, Alan Shivers, you know, married Mary Alice Sherry.
Yes.
And I think he has very extensive holdings now. But there's some people. I think one of the black marks against the land company was overselling people. They would sell a man a piece of land or a family, and they'd have a speaker who'd tell how much they could make the first year from boom corn or vegetables, something of that sort. And those people put everything they had, some of them, into a piece of land that was heavily mortgaged, thinking that in a year or two or three, they'd be able to have the land free of mortgage, you see. They'd be able to pay it off. And that it didn't work that way for too many of them. Mm-hmm. It was different in my father's case because he traded just an extra farm, a 300-acre farm in northern Iowa, for the land down here. And he had a great deal to go on besides that.
Mm-hmm.
And goodness knows he made money down here. Everyone up there predicted he'd be broke, you know, in a few years. We had a 465-acre farm, good Iowa land where we lived, that of course wasn't even touched for this, plus other holdings.
Mm-hmm. But when you left Iowa, did you all have the intention that you were going to stay? I mean, it wasn't
Yes, my older brothers had married. There were four older brothers and then the three, and an older sister, then the three of us who came had the harrowing trip down here from San Antonio. And when the boys married and left the farm, it was too much for my father. And he was ready to call it quits up there and move down to a warmer climate. I was a very homesick little girl. I cried every day. I'd go to school, our car was broken, my sister was sick part of the time. And the school was strange, of course, and my only consolation was that in a year we'd go back home to live. Well, when we went back in August, I was over my homesickness, and I wouldn't have lived any place but the valley.
I think that the valley is a place that, like when I first came here in '60, people told me that you either like it or you're going to hate it. And I think that this is true because I've enjoyed, you know, the years that I've been down here. And I think that, well, after I left, I thought about, you know, when I quit teaching all this, before I'm going to come back. It's just a nice place.
And people have come back. People have left. They've talked, well, they wanted to get away, and before long they were back down here. Every part of the country has drawbacks.
Well, that's true. But this is really just a pleasant, you know, just the atmosphere and everything. Of course, you were saying you were homesick there. What conditions did you find, you know, as a child here as far as school and just life in general? You know, like for a 12-year-old girl, and what did you find?
Well, I found from March until the end of school, we attended the Far San Juan Alamo school. And I suppose I was homesick and I wasn't very happy down there. But we then, in the summer, we started attending the Methodist Church South then, it was called, in McAllen. And many of the little girls gave me such a warm welcome that I soon was over my homesickness. I became a campfire girl. And I don't like camping trips very well. I suppose this has something to do with it. When I was about 13, I think, it was summertime, the campfire girls went on a camping trip down to Lake Camp Cross. It lasted 4 or 5 days. We had to cook our food over an open fire, and I didn't enjoy that. But to top it all, when I got home, my face started to break out, and I had a good case of poison ivy. I think that conditioned me against camping trips. But we had church activities, and then, of course, in high school, we had sports, football, no stadiums in those days. The spectators ran up and down the sidelines rooting for their respective teams. But we had baseball, and even the men in the town would play baseball. I remember my father played with the Fats, although he weighed over 200. Somehow I didn't think he was fat. I think he was misplaced, and I wasn't a bit happy about that. But we'd go on fishing trips down to the Resaca. The men would take a seine and catch the fish, and the women would cook the fish there on the spot. We had numerous activities. We always had a 4th of July celebration. Ride a horse sometimes in the parade. We had, what else did we? Oh, swimming parties. I learned to swim out in the pool at Alan Shiver's home. It was the Sherry Clubhouse at that time, and the pool was open to the public.
Were they operated by independence or by the government? Or?
I think independence. I'm sure they were.
And then, what about the Border Patrol wasn't really as prevalent at the time.
No, I don't think we didn't hear much about the Border Patrol then. Of course, there were soldiers down here then, you know. And I think it must have been after the soldiers were moved out. I suppose there were some Rangers here. But I don't recall just when the Border Patrol became active down here.
Were the Rangers there? Were they strong here in McAllen or in this area here? They never did come around this part, I don't know.
Not especially. This John Peavy, now I knew his family very well, and his sister and his brothers were younger than he. And he was, wasn't he with the Rangers one time?
Was.
I think he was. He's written a history of this part of the country, I think.
When you spoke of, the swimming parties and stuff, and then the 4th of July celebrations, were there any other festivals or anything that you all participated in? Of course, now, I think that quite a few of the people would associate festivals with the people from Mexico, you know, but what involvement did you all have here? Was this purely from everybody involved in it, or what?
Well, there were the fiestas And the concessionaires would come in, you know, with all sorts of shows and games of chance and so on. And we'd always go once or twice to the fiesta. And of course the name, as it implies, is Spanish, you see. Of course there would be many Latin American people there, but the Anglo-Americans went too. And then we had, we'd have parades, I remember. I don't know what that parade was, but they had some pictures of it taken in the early days. And we had school parades. This float here, you see, is a picture taken of our senior float. We put, I don't think it was limited to school. I think it was, as I recall, it was more extensive than just a school parade.
Possibly in May or...
Yes, this was toward the end of the school. No, it wasn't either. It was in the winter. Because we had this, I think, along in the winter. It was cool. Mm. I remember we had the car happened to be my car that we decorated, and we took it in the basement of the old, which was a high school building, then next to the old gym up at Central Elementary here in McAllen. And I remember one night we were working with cold because I wore a wool dress. I remember that. So it must have been pretty chilly or cold. And we used the Spanish moss to decorate the car, you see. So, and that's at its best, isn't it, along in the wintertime?
Speaking of, you know, the wool dress and everything, what type of clothing did the people wear during this time? I mean, was it, I'm sure that it was, you know, designed for the area and everything like this, but were there any different types of clothing down here than what you experienced in Iowa? And then was there anything that you would say was more inclined to be customary to this area here?
Not necessarily. Of course, most of the people had some warm clothes when they came here from the Middle West. I had a coat till I outgrew it, and then the next winter coat I bought in Marshalltown, Iowa, when we were visiting there, and it was a heavy plush like these fake fur coats now, you know, coat. And we wore heavy sweaters, those real heavy sweaters, you know, and wool dresses, and we didn't dress too differently any more than the people do now. Right. People up north don't bundle up the way we'd expect them to in zero weather, you know. I'm working on a book review now, the Dirksen book. I have to give a study club this thing. I was a member for 15 years. I went in as a bride, and then I was out for about 30 years teaching, and then they took me back in and stuck me with a guest day book review.
I think that would be...
That's really a book. It's not too much written. She's not an author. His wife, you know, wrote it. Honorable Mr. Marigold. And he was quite a guy. Mm-hmm. Real American.
Also, I can read it. There have been so many changes in education just, you know, all over, but what was the school situation like when you came here? And then what changes have you seen through the years? And then, now, I think you taught at McAllen for another year. You taught for about 30 years at Auburn.
32 years. And then I taught Bible for 4 years, two classes a day in the McAllen High School before I went back to teaching.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, what changes have you seen as far as education is concerned?
You don't have that on
there. Yes,
ma'am. Oh, you do. One big change is in enrollment. In fact, we have so many schools now that I couldn't even count them. When I came, we had the high school building, which wasn't yet completed, which was the annex to the Central Elementary School now, and then a little two-story gray stucco building that stood on the site where the other Central Elementary School is. There were 26 in my graduating class, and I think 3 or 4 postgraduates. You know what a postgraduate is, someone who goes back and takes some extra courses after he's graduated. we thought it was a very good school. I came from a little one-room country school, so coming to the valley was a big step upward for me. Here we had just, in McAllen School, just one grade for one teacher, and that was really something, instead of eight grades for one teacher. And when we got into high school, we had numerous activities. We had literary clubs, the barbarians and the Indians. I was a barbarian. And we had different contests, speaking contests of various types, a competition between the two literary societies. We had, many of our students took expression or elocution, it was called back in the old days. I remember my sister and brother both took. And my sister took dancing. I had a teacher who taught dancing, not as a part of the curriculum, but she was a part of the school. And, oh yes, we had a music teacher who had a little studio in the high school where we could not even have to leave campus, you see, to have our music lesson. We had interscholastic league, as I mentioned earlier. We had football, baseball, track events, and many more track events for girls than they have now. And, of course, girls' basketball games, the courts were all outside courts. And needless to say, we had many skin knees, you know. We wore the full black sateen bloomers that bloused down over our knees with white midi blouses and dark Windsor ties, black Windsor ties. And we had to wear long stockings. If a girl ever rolled her stockings below her knees, she was immediately called on the carpet and told to cover her knees. We had other interscholastic league contests. We had debates. We had declamation. I represented our school in debate. I remember the question was the open and closed shop question back in those days. And, of course, the affirmative always won in favor of open shop, letting a man work where he wanted to work, for what he wanted to work, under what conditions he wanted to work. That old plea to democracy always won. I attended the University of Texas for 4 years. I said one thing I'd never be was a school teacher. At the end of my first year, I thought, well, Dale, you're not preparing yourself to do one thing. You might have to work someday. I started taking education courses and did my student teaching in Austin High School. And along with my degree, I received my permanent teacher certificate. Mm-hmm. At that time, I was engaged to be married, but I had never earned any money, so I decided I'd see if I could support myself for a year. So I taught in the Harlingen High School. I suppose I got the job because Mr. Fitz, who was then the superintendent, had been my high school principal for 2 years in McAllen. That was a small school, too, with 8 or 10 teachers in the senior high school. They did have a junior high and a senior high, both in 1926 and 27. I married at the end of school. In the university, they taught us the finest thing a girl could do in the education courses was to go back home. It was hard, but it was the best thing she could do, go back home and prove herself as a teacher. I came back home, but they wouldn't give a home girl a job. So that's the reason I went to Harlingen to teach. After I married, they were hiring home girls, but not married teachers.
Not married teachers.
Not married teachers. So the 4 years after I married, before our son was born, 4.5 years, I could have been teaching. Mm-hmm. But because of that ruling, I did do some substitute teaching.
When you say you did your practice teaching at Austin, you didn't by chance have a Mrs. Pennybacker as a teacher, did you? Was she there at that time?
No. Dr. Henderson was the one who taught Education 27, which was the practice teaching, the theory, and then of course we went into Boston.
This lady had taught English there for many years and had written several books.
I remember the name, but I didn't. I didn't ever. I had Dr. Payne as my freshman English instructor, who had written the American and English literature books, the history of American literature that we used in high school. I was fortunate. He was a wonderful instructor, wonderful man.
And we'll go back to this. To your enterprise later then. What schools were in, of course, I guess Brownsville or?
No, at that time, the district was, the schools, was made up of the schools in Hidalgo County. Now, we played basketball against, and we debated against Mission and Far San Juan Alamo, Edinburgh, Donna, Mercedes, and then Weslaco, after Weslaco became a town site, you know. But our district was comprised only of the schools in this county at that time. So there was later a change. I don't remember just when that change came in. But and then of course I started teaching in the high school in 1937, but I went on as a Bible instructor. And I taught Bible. I had one class the first semester, and then from then on for 4 years I had two classes, one in junior high and one in senior high. I had all the little scrub beds and the football players, and it really was a, most of them thought it was a very wonderful course.
It's, that was part of the regular curriculum.
It was, but it had to be supported by outside organizations. None of the state funds could be used. But at that time, we used the school plant, and I was able to get it affiliated. We gave our final examinations. We gave our tests right along with the other academic courses. But it had to be financed out
there. I think that's something that would be nice if they could have it again, you know, get it back into the system, because...
Well, so many just don't know anything about the Bible. It was taught for the literary, the moral, and the literary and moral values. Mm-hmm. And if there were, I never had any trouble at all, any religious argument. If there were any controversial point, I explained that certain members of certain denominations believe this way, others this way, and others still another way, but you believe the way you want to. Mm-hmm. And if they, one little girl said, well, how do you believe? I said, it doesn't make any difference how I believe. You go to your minister or your parents and work that out for yourself. Mm-hmm. And I taught Jewish children, I taught Catholics, I taught Methodist, Presbyterian, Baptist, Church of God, many different denominations, as well as different.
Of course, with all the constitutional change of the laws and stuff like this, well, it's hard to have anything like that in school nowadays.
Yes, it is. It's hard to even have a prayer since Madeleine O'Hara.
Yeah.
You know, one thing Senator Dirksen worked so hard for was the prayer amendment, to have prayers put back into the public schools.
Oh, I
thought there was a weakness, a moral fiber of our country was weakened,
sure.
And children needed to learn the value of religious worship very early in life.
That's true, because I think it's like everything else as far as rulers are concerned. The kids, they say they want freedom, but yet they want, they appreciate the teacher that is firm with them and makes them understand the rules and regulations, because they're looking for it, even though they say they're not.
I think so, too. Might be interesting to you, I taught three classes in psychology this last year in high school before I retired. We had six classes, another teacher taught three, and I had three.
I thought that was really interesting.
It was really interesting, and I'm sure it was very, very valuable to many of the students. In fact, many of them told me that they were beginning to understand themselves better, their parents better. They were getting along better at home.
Well, do you think that with the schools offering more subjects, so a wider range, that the students are going to have a better outlook as far as school is concerned?
I'm sure they are. Now, McAllen High School now has something they didn't have back in my day, and that was classes in art.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Now, I think last year we had one full-time art teacher and then one of the coaches, a head coach, mm-hmm. football coach, taught some two classes in art, and then the mechanical drawing teacher had some art classes. There don't seem to be so many in what we used to call manual training. Mm-hmm. I was a little disappointed. I had a bookcase made for me, and it didn't quite measure up to the work the boys used to do. Perhaps the reason for that is that we have a big vocational school, a separate building, and we have a building trade. Those boys go out and construct a house in that class each year.
I think this is, the way things, the changes that they've made have all been so much better because, well, what do they say, 48% of the high school seniors or high school student body, they will go to college. 52% are going to be out in the, in the job field, not just literally field, but going into various types of work and everything. And I think this is something that, Mike Allen has always sponsored a good program, I think.
Of course, we have a cosmetology program, as well as radio and television repair, and auto mechanics, and of course for office workers, where they go out, they learn the techniques from their books and their teacher in the morning, and then work in offices in the afternoon. And also, of course, we have had distributed education. That has to do with the sales end for a number of years, but that has been broadened into the mechanical field, yes, and into the secretarial, yes, field.
Well, I think that's really, to me, these programs are real, real necessary, and they do a tremendous job with you. During these, of course, now, since I came in 60, I left when Buell, I guess it was, hit. But have you, have there been any other storms or hurricanes or anything like this that, Buell was damaging because of the water standing so long. But people always talk about the hurricane of 1919 or something like this. Can you recall any of the bad weather?
In 1919, the fall, I think it was September 20th, there was a hurricane, but it was not too damaging to the valley, as I recall. That was the time Corpus Christi, before they had the seawall, was flooded. There was, I know, a local family. They have passed away since then. The E.M. Card, he was a civil engineer here in the valley for a number of years. And they were in Corpus in a hotel, and they were just swept out of the hotel. And she took one of the little girls, and he took the other. Fortunately, they were both good swimmers. They didn't know all night where the wife didn't know whether the husband and other child was safe, and he didn't know whether she and the child she had was safe. The next morning, when it was light, they were not too far apart, but that was a bad hurricane. I don't recall that we had too much damage here. Now, the storm of the hurricane in 1933 was a bad one. I remember that very distinctly. And it took roofs off houses and blew in windows and plate glass. And probably, as I recall, there was more actual damage caused by the wind than there was during Buell. Would go to Lake Cambacost North in Mercedes in an army truck on a swimming party, which would mean a picnic too, perhaps roasting wieners and marshmallows out in the open.
Did during this time, was there any fear of raids or anything from Mexico? Or of course, now I don't really know. Villa was gone probably at 17 or 18. He was out, but. Did the people, were they relaxed in regard to this?
Not entirely. I recall my oldest brother came down to supervise the building of our home, and I recall his saying he slept with a gun by his side at night. When we came, that first summer we were here, now there was no raiding here, but we could hear the guns across the river. Mm. Those revolutionaries, you know. I've never liked Mexico. That first summer, I was still just 12 years old, I went to Matamoros, Brownsville, took the little electric motor that used to run up and down the Missouri Pacific track to Brownsville, and then we took the ferry boat across to Matamoros, and we went from the boat up to the main part of town in a horse-drawn vehicle. It was a streetcar, I guess you'd call it, like a streetcar. And I was frightened all the time I was there. We went to the boneyard, of course, the cemetery. We went to the market. And one other place, what was it? The fort. We ate our lunch over there. Bought a few Cheerios and then came back. And we got on this horse-drawn car, streetcar. And some soldiers with their guns got on. And those little black beady eyes, you know, would look right through us. And I was just shaking. I was so frightened. I suppose they were there to protect us. But I was very, very glad to see Old Glory, you know, floating on the Brownsville side of the river, and I was certainly glad when we approached it.
Well, now you say that you took the ferry. Of course, the only way you could cross was either Brownsville or Matamoros or Reynosa, where they had ferries.
They had ferries, both places, yes. Yeah. But of course, we didn't have to flood it. We had that.
Well, it seems strange that with all of the improvements that they've made as far as flood controls and floodways and everything, that Beulah was able to do so much damage here. But I guess all up and down the valley, that, you know, things were really, really hurt.
Well, that water, I guess, was not allowed to go down, mm-hmm. down the valley into the Gulf as it should have been. I've heard it said that it was a man-made flood. That it was just poor management or technique or whatever you want to call it in controlling that water. That it was really not necessary for all of that water to be held back and then allowed to come down in such a sweep as it did. Harlingen was pathetic. That fine residential section was just... I didn't see how they'd ever bring it back. They did.
Well, they've made so many improvements over there in the Gulf. Say in the past 5 years that since the storm happened, it's really wonderful how people can recover mm-hmm. during the time of disaster. So
many of those people had heavily mortgaged homes, and there wasn't much of anything they could do but to repair them because they were worth so little. And if the loan companies wanted to come back on those people. They didn't want them back. They would be responsible for the amount of the loan. So most of them just dug in and repaired their home.
I talked to a fellow boy who played ball for me in San Antonio. His father was one of the mortgage investors or one of the mortgage bankers that had quite a bit of property there in Harlingen, or they had money tied up in it. And he just moved down here for about, I guess, almost a year. They had so much paperwork to do, but they picked themselves up and took care of it.
Just like they do every place else. Look at the war-torn country. After World War II, all that bombing that those people had to do.
Well, say for example, during World War II here, I recall that when I came down in '60, of course this was well after World War II, but they had the detention center out here, and they had, Abel or Rosenberg, there was a man and wife that were two of the leading spies.
I don't remember much about that.
I was just wondering, what effect the war had in the Valley area, say in World War II, and also during the Korean conflict, such as it was.
I don't recall that it had much effect. I do know that we had a very tightly closed border during World War II, and you didn't take a camera across the river, and a soldier could not go across in uniform. He had to have a special permit to go across. is a young man visiting us from the station close to San Antonio, and we couldn't take him across the river. Now, a bunch of them, I think, did go across at Laredo, but I think they had a special permit at some time, but they couldn't go across as freely, especially those that were not stationed close by, you know. Of course, at Moorefield, I don't know if those fellows went across. I know they did. And I don't recall just that you had Moorefield that was open at that time during World War II. My husband worked out there as a civilian
worker. Air Base on Mission?
Yes, North Mission. He was in charge of the commissary out there. I remember one interesting thing. The only grade school teaching I did was to finish from the 1st of November on the end of the year, 8th. Second grade, the second and third, over at Wilson School, and I had one little boy, Roger Sullivan, beautiful child, came in from Chicago. His mother was much older than you would expect. He would sit all day long and draw swastikas on his paper. I said, Roger, why do you do that? I don't know. I don't know. Of course, it worried me. My husband was at Moorefield. I didn't know it, but until after the war, he was working with intelligence. And that family was investigated, and they left here very suddenly. Mm. Of course, Chicago was a hotbed of Nazism, you know, at that time. But of course, it was a long time after that I found out that the family was investigated.
That's, it seems so strange that you would have anything like that. Well, I say in Texas, of course, but, in San Antonio, as you go out toward Austin or out toward Randolph Air Base, mm-hmm. there's a beautiful house on top of the hill out there. It's kind of an oriental design. And we used to go by there when I lived in Austin, everything. And they said during World War II that they used this thing as a spy house for the Japanese, and they finally, caught up that they were checking on all the airplane landings at Randolph. Mm-hmm. And it seems so strange, that we would have anything like that here in the United States. I've always just felt like we were so far removed from everything. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I remember during World War I, these people were very good friends about it, but he was a German. And I couldn't really verify this, but the story is that he was charged and fed by the Ku Klux Klan because he was blowing off his mouth, pro-German, Mm. And really, people were suspicious of anyone with a German name. And they were somewhat in World War II, not entirely, but I know a little boy, one little boy that was in that room, never had a quarter for a war savings bank. Never, mm-hmm. never did. But we were just a little suspicious that they were pro-German, uh-huh. But now, could you imagine anyone feeling pro-anything but usually anti-American, isn't it?
It's so strange that it's like that now. But possibly, I guess I know during World War II, just from what little I can recall from it, just everyone's feeling was a united effort.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is something that we're lacking. We've got, the laws have been changing so much now that they've really taken away from the collective spirit, I think. Of course, I don't know.
Well, there certainly is a lack of something, of Americanism, as we used to think of it, of Americanism.
When you spoke of the Klan, was the Klan active in this area?
They operated down here some. Hmm. Not extensively, I don't think.
I've always heard of the Klan, but I've never seen him. Maybe I've talked to him, I don't know. But
Well, I don't know either. And of course, this this man was just the type. He was a little short, barrel-chested fella, mm-hmm. and he talked a lot, and I could see that he could get into trouble.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But, of course, I didn't see any tar or feathers on him.
Yeah. one thing that that, like in Central Texas, I can recall the old Civilian Conservation Corps and some of the things that that Roosevelt put into effect in helping get rid of the Depression out of the Depression and everything. Were any of his programs active down here? This is strictly for my own curiosity because, you know, so many of the schools up around Austin and that area there are built by the old PWA and WPA.
Well, now, I believe, now, if I'm not mistaken, weren't these levees down here built about that time? No, that was a boundary commission that built that. That was called the boundary commission, wasn't it?
I think so.
That built that.
Yeah.
I think we had some of those workers, the same as every other place, but I don't recall that they were maybe as active. Now, we had a brother-in-law who... he was in the National Guard, and he was out in, I think, in California, someplace in the West, in the CCC camp, is that what they call them?
CCC.
Yeah, and he spent quite a little time out there, working with boys, you know. Then later he went back then into the service and retired as a colonel from the Army. But I don't recall that. You see, we had plenty of laborers down here, as I recall, most of the time, until they started shipping a lot of them up north, you know. And I don't think too many of those Latin American people, those laborers. Of course, we had unemployment. We had what they called the Hoover Camp out here. In West McAllen, the soup kitchen, you know, and there was a soup kitchen where people could go, and there was a long line there during the Depression. People getting free food, you know, and out in what was, where this college was supposed to be, never was built, College Heights, there was this Hoover camp where these cars of people would come in. They were Anglo-American people. And perhaps they'd have an old Model T Ford, and they'd put up a lean-to the side of their car and build a little fire in the open and exist out there for a while. Because we got some of those down here because, you see, they didn't have the problem of fuel that they had in some of the other states. Because California got most of those MIGs, as they were called, you know, from Oklahoma during the Depression.
Well, after reading The Great Giraffe and seeing the movie and everything, I know I lived in California when I was in about the fourth grade, and it was real strange. The people there, I went into a drugstore and they asked me, said, "Where are you from, boy?" And I said, "I'm from Texas." I said, "Okay, you can stay." And I was, you know, so inside, I said, why does it make a difference where I'm from? I said, "Well, if you're from Arkansas or Oklahoma, you'd have to get out."
Yeah.
And I couldn't believe that people would, you know, turn against each other like that. But I guess it was a good feeling.
Well, of course, it was. The Californians were incensed when Steinbeck wrote that book, you know.
Yeah.
But perhaps he bettered conditions.
Yeah.
Now, back in those days, during the Depression, this labor camp out here on McCall, all these little houses painted a buff yellow, were built. That was a government project for the low-income people where they could have adequate housing. Now it's been taken over. It was taken over many years ago. I think the city of McAllen has a 99-year lease on it. And then Rapama Village over here was built later. Now we do have those housing that were, and this was owned by the government.
What
Do
you think just from a general observation, what do you think the valley, the growth of the valley, and what do you think the conditions are now? Do you think it's a good place to live, no doubt, but as far as businesses and different types of life and everything, what do you think of the future of the valley?
Well, I think that it's going to become more and more a tourist resort area. We do know that the oil, people who have oil their land lease, their royalties are falling off. We have some little ones, and they're not what they used to be at all. And we hear that the supply is perhaps being depleted. At least the oil is not being developed down here as it was at one time, you know. And people aren't getting their income from oil. Our luck at farming, we have some land. 2 out of 3 years, we didn't get a dime off this beautiful 20 acres out here that's worth about, $1,500 or $2,000 an acre. Fortunately, we don't have to have it, and someday it'll be subdivision land, either from Edinburgh or McAllen, probably Edinburgh, from the 4 mile line on McCall. But I don't know what this sugar cane is going to amount to, this program, you know. The government is, I think, is subsidizing growers of sugar cane. Of course, it takes 2 years before that, I think, produces, doesn't it?
I think so.
We had sugar cane in the early days down here. We used to have broom corn, and that was a big cane crop. Cotton doesn't make the money it once did for farmers. Citrus is still a good paying crop if we don't get another freeze.
This is the thing. Of course, it seems like the freeze is coming about every 10 years, don't they?
Something like that.
I know, again, when I came in 60, well, they had the big freeze in 51.
Mm-hmm.
And then 61, we had another hard freeze and pretty well wiped out everything. And so it seemed like it's just kind of 10 years.
Yes, this 20 acres was a 20 beautiful orchard at one time. We had another 5 acre orange orchard, but the freeze. But your citrus will pay off.
So you can just keep it.
That's right. It costs considerably to spray your trees and water and take the care that needs to be taken of a grove, but still a pretty good money crop. Vegetables, if you hit. But we're not. We just don't hit.
Yeah, that's the bad thing about those vegetables.
Mm-hmm.
You don't know when the market is going to...
Onions, we had 12,000 sacks of onions on that 20 acres 1 year, and we got about 10 cents a sack.
Mm-hmm.
We should have gotten a dollar at least. The time you pay, your renter gets 4/5, I think, or something like that. You get about a fourth. I guess it's a fourth.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, you don't make tax. But when you look around, you see all this extensive housing development. We have this new complex of apartments just north on 2nd Street, north of the Lutheran Church. And before that, even a third of the complex was completed, people were moving in to the ones that were finished, and I suppose it's pretty well filled up now. And there are other areas all over town like that. Frankly, I don't know. I don't know what is. Now, these people came in and moved in here before the tourists came. Many of them.
The tourist business is really.
Oh, and another thing, Reynosa, business from Reynosa. And the merchants are going to do everything they can to get business from across the river. Because they have sales like they've never had before. In the stores. You go downtown on Saturday, it's Little Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
You'd hardly get along the street, and they're all carrying packages.
I learned that, you know, when I first came, my wife and I were going, we'd drive down 10th Street going toward Reynosa there, and we saw all the people sitting on the curb, you know, tearing stuff out of their clothes, and we couldn't figure out what they were doing. I said, they were putting something on, and, you know, some of the students finally tell me, you know, well, folks, what they really have to take, they can't take new stuff back. It has to be without a label, or it has to be worn, and so they'll just put it on and wear it across, and there's no problem.
They do it. They'll have 5 or 6 layers deep of clothes.
And it's so...
If they have it on, it's not new, it's worn.
It's really, I think this is something that people need to...
I remember, though, my husband was in the grocery store. Well, he first worked for another man. He came down here and helped him put in the store. And some of those restaurants over there, you know, across would take all these fine brands of food over, you know, and then they'd put something else on top of the boxes, you know, so they could get it across. So it's,
always have a way, I guess.
They have a way of getting it over, I guess, without costing me too much. And then another, of course, not only the winter tourists, the ones who come here and stay from 3 to 6 months out of the year. And incidentally, a number of those tourists have bought homes down here. And we had a renter that finally bought a home. And there's people over here that that spend about 9 months out of the year. They're northern people. And when they do that, then they're residents, yeah. You know. And then, too, we have tourists all summer long, many of them pulling trailers, you know, campers and campers that go into Mexico.
I think that there seems to be a trend, like you say, of people buying homes here, because I know a friend of mine that I cooked with in San Antonio, his parents found a place in Harlingen, and they bought them a trailer, it's a two-bedroom trailer house, and so they simply leave it there year round now, and they come down and take 6 months and go back.
Many of them do that. Yeah. My brother, the one that came down on that initial trip, have bought. They lived in Eagle Pass, had a beautiful home. Then they lived over on Date Palm, and they sold it just before Beulah, and the water came up. You know, they kept on renting it, and then finally the man sold it, and they're out in this Palm City mobile home right out here with the Elks Club, and it's a beautiful place, and many of those have their mobile homes out there, and they're gone in the summer, and they come back to the winter time. Oh, I forgot to tell you something else on here. What was there to do? We had what was called wasn't Cultural Arts Program. They had those more recent years over at Edinburgh. I think they were Lyceum.
Yeah.
You know, and the prominent people would underwrite these. We in the north, when I was local, we had Chautauqua. And that was a concentrated form of culture that was brought in maybe August for 2 weeks. And the people would go in the afternoon and then at night. My first magician I saw the Chautauqua program. And my mother heard William Jennings Bryan. I heard the Rainbow Band, uh-huh. You know, that after World War I when I was just a little kid. I heard that on the Chautauqua platform. Uh-huh. But they had these Lyceum. I think that's what they called it down here, yeah. And they would come in at intervals like the cultural arts and the community concerts. Mm-hmm. So now they had that, you see, when I was in high school, when I was just a kid. So we weren't entirely cut off from culture.
Well, by the time you got to high school, though, they had built the road in from South Uris and then possibly had a little bit better transportation.
Well, that road from South Uris was built after I was in high school. While I was in high school. Wasn't before that. But, of course, everything came by railroad. Circuses. Oh, yes, we've had circuses down here. We never did have Ringling Brothers or those big ones, you know. But we had Cole Circus and they came by railroad, you know. Now circuses travel by van, I guess, don't they?
Most of the time, I think it's...
Well, back in those days, they traveled by. They had a circus train, and going down to watch the circus unload was really something, you know.
I think that watching them unload and set up is more interesting than the actual event itself.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.